From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be, across the nation, around the world, I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Next hour, his guest name is Dr. J. Marvin Herndon. We're going to talk some real science with him about planet Earth. Some stuff will rock your foundation, your belief system about this planet. Indeed. Back from Washington, D.C., had a great time. Met for the second time our buddy Ian Punnett, and Ian and I exchanged some things. I'm going to get Ian on as an hour guest in the not-too-distant future, and then he's going to reciprocate. I'll be on his program on a Saturday. Just a little bit of who is Ian. It'll be fun to be able to do that. You know, on the plane from St. Louis to Washington, D.C., I carry a small little portable video DVD player, and I was watching The Day the Earth Stood Still, that fantastic 1951 film. What was so cool about it, because going to Washington, D.C., was to meet all our 500 affiliates, members of the Coast to Coast family. They were all there for a little bash and a greet and meet, and we talked about the program and everything else. Well, one of our favorite affiliates, of course, is in Washington, D.C., WMAL-AM. And on the plane, going to the affiliates meeting to see the folks from WMAL and every place else, I'm watching The Day the Earth Stood Still. And one of the opening scenes of that movie, an old announcer pops up, and you've got this huge mic logo of WMAL. And these are the old ones now. In the old days, and I have one from my very first radio station, WCAR, in Detroit at the time. They've changed the call letter since. But these were huge metal, iron, just things that stuck on the microphone, and it said WMAL, and it was really neat. It was impressive, and to know that we're on that fine station in Washington, D.C., and then just to see it in the movie was just kind of neat. Well, talking about things that are kind of neat, a few weeks ago, Tom and I were invited to the Magic Castle in Los Angeles to see some magicians do their thing. Well, the fellow who invited us was a guy by the name of Brandon Scott, a magician and a darn good one. But his real avocation, what he really loves, in addition to magic, of course, is investigating UFOs. And he entered a film that he produced along with J.J. Bartmittler at the March 4th Laughlin, Nevada UFO Conference. It was called the 15th Annual International UFO Congress. His movie was called Alien Secrets, They're Here and Living Among Us. And darn it, they won. It was the best film, selected as the best feature. So congratulations to you, JJ, and Brandon Scott, for that fine job. Now, this is my last week in St. Louis before I head back to Los Angeles. And I do want to tell you, we are in for some rough weather over the next couple days, they say. As a matter of fact, I just got an email in from a meteorologist who simply said, George, my coworkers and I, we listen to Coast nightly. I'm passing some information on to you because it will undoubtedly become a topic in your opening news briefs with your show and hopefully will not go beyond that. When I saw that, I went, oh, really? Well, according to our graphs, he goes on to write, and models, the Midwest sections of the U.S., including your hometown of St. Louis, are prime for a severe weather outbreak. The next 5 days look to be the most critical. We are right in the middle of our models, and if they hold up, we may well see over 70 tornadoes. Can you believe that? 70 tornadoes in the Midwest, along with other severe weather. So here we go again. We've got some backup generators. I have never tested them in terms of how long they will last, but we're ready just in case. Well, the old saying, to whom the bell tolls, well, AT&T is ringing its bell. They talk now because of their merger with Bell South, they're going to cut 10,000 more jobs. AT&T plans to cut up to 10,000 jobs, mostly through attrition. That's the only good thing of this thing, except they're not going to be hiring new people. It's a $67 billion purchase of Bell South Corporation, and if it goes through, and it probably will, that's what they plan to do, cut 10,000 jobs. The workforce reduction would take place over 3 years. The acquisition is expected to close next year. Now, before the cuts, the combined company would have around 317,000 employees, including Singular Wireless, which is now a joint AT&T Bell South venture. The 10,000 planned cuts are in addition to the 26,000 job cuts that AT&T has already announced. I bring this story up to your attention merely because we have a lot of jobs in this country that are simply going away. A University of North Carolina graduate from Iran accused of running down 9 people on campus to avenge the treatment of Muslims said at a hearing Monday that he was thankful for the opportunity to spread the will of Allah. Now, this guy also called 911 during the accident. He was accused of driving a sport utility vehicle through what is called the pit, a popular campus gathering spot, injuring 9 people, none, thank God, seriously injured. A British official inquiry into the 1997 death of Princess Diana in a high-speed car crash has found no evidence now of foul play. The Daily Mail, it's a newspaper, said the interim report to be published in May by former Metropolitan Police Commissioner Sir John Stevens will dismiss conspiracy theories about the deaths of Diana, her boyfriend Dodi Fayed, and their chauffeur Honoré Paul in a Paris tunnel. Those theories include an allegation that Prince Charles was plotting to kill his former wife by staging a car accident. Fayed's father, Mohammed Al-Fayed, who owns Harrods department store in London, has said he suspects not only Charles, but also his father, Prince Philip. The 2-year investigation by 10 detectives will say that even a skilled racing driver would have had difficulty controlling the Mercedes carrying Diana as it hurtled through the Pont des Almas tunnel in Paris. In Boston, Massachusetts, police were searching for 2 people who attacked a homeless man as he slept in a park. They set his legs on fire. In Los Angeles, some good news. 2 prosthetic legs stolen from a 16-year-old California girl. We talked about this story. Well, they have mysteriously turned up in her mother's van. The second time in 3 months that an artificial limb belonging to the teen has been taken and returned. They're playing some game with her, but she's not laughing. A giant crater made by a meteorite impact millions of years ago has been discovered in Egypt's western desert. What's so fascinating about this story is that even with all the satellite imagery that we've had over all these years, they're still finding these things. Boston University experts found a 19-mile-wide crater while studying satellite images of the area. It is more than twice the size of the next largest Saharan impact depression and more than 25 times the size of Arizona's famous meteor crater. Incredible story sent to us by science advisor Richard C. Hoagland, who heads up the EnterpriseMission.com. Here's the headline. Is mysterious red rain first evidence of life in space? Need I say any more? In a moment, Richard C. Hoagland to explain this story and many others on Coast to Coast AM. What's so good about having the EnterpriseMission.com website around it, Richard C. Hoagland, as our Coast to Coast Science Advisor? It's because every morning when I open up my emails, Richard has done so much work, so much investigations into stories that are going on that affect all of us or that are fascinating. I don't have to do much work. And he's done it again. He has found a story, what is called the mysterious red rain, which could be the first evidence of life in space. How in the heck did you uncover this one, Richard?
Because I have a great network of spies all around the planet. Better than
good.
The CIA.
I think you do. As a matter of fact, also.
Enterprise Associates. In fact, let me mention a couple of them. Rick Sterling is one who sends me extraordinary leads. And this actually, I think, came from him. But there are many others, and at the appropriate times we'll mention them. But this is such an amazing story, George, because it confirms a couple of discussions you and I had only a few weeks ago.
Well, not only that, the picture of the guy on the clipping that you sent me, Milton Wainwright, he looks like a little heavier J. Allen Hynek, doesn't he?
Well, now, Milton is not the principal of the story. So let me go through the story, and then we'll
get to
the details.
All right, and tell us about it, and then tell us what the heck this red rain is.
Okay, this started in India back in July and September of 2001. And it is the product of the research of a Dr. Godfrey Lewis, who was a physicist at the School of Pure and Applied Physics at Mahatma Gandhi University in Kerala, India.
Hmm.
In that period of time, in July and September of 2001, over Kerala, something like 150,000 pounds of mysterious red particles in the rain fell on Kerala. And Dr. Godfrey Lewis was smart enough to pick up some of the samples, take them into the lab, and look at them under a microscope, and found to his astonishment that they weren't sand or red dust. Remember how Art had a story a few years ago about red dust here in the Southwest that came from China?
Yes.
This appeared to look like biological cells. In fact, they look like red blood cells under Dr. Lewis's microscope. So he began a research program with a student who I want to give proper credit to, Santosh Kumar. And the reason all this is important is their research has now reached the level where in the next few days it's going to be published in the peer-reviewed Astrophysical Journal of Astrophysics and Space Science. This is not National Enquirer stuff. This is real science, and it's astonishing in its implications because when he did further biological analysis, he found that primarily the materials, the cell-like looking things, and on his website there's an actual picture of them, which is not in the Yorkshire Post story. So let me give out Dr. Lewis's website, and everybody can go and take a look at this. It's http://education.vsnl, V as in Victor, SNL.com/Godfrey, and that will take you directly to the site where he's posted a synopsis of his own work, the papers, and the photographs of this remarkable stuff. I mean, it's amazing. These things look like blood cells. But when he analyzed them, they had no DNA. And they're not hemoglobin. They're not blood cells. And it's from this lack of DNA that he came to the startling conclusion that they appeared to be some kind of non-terrestrial, extraterrestrial life form with a different genetic code than all of life on Earth.
It is incredible. But it would also be incredible if this is a seed that somehow goes throughout the universe.
Well, yeah, and the question then is, why did it, you know, somehow explode? Because he tracked down a report of an aerial explosion over Kerala, which indicated that, like over Tunguska, something may have come in and exploded in an airburst, and then, you know, in the stratosphere, it would have, you know, stayed aloft for months, and then every time it rained, some of the stuff would have come down, depending upon the convection currents. 150,000 pounds is what he calculates came in from somewhere.
Rapid Lex has got a link posted under Hot Stories now. So
Lex,
you just scroll down. He's got a lot of stories there, so you'll find it down there somewhere. You
now,
know,
where this went next is that, remember I mentioned when we were talking about the Stardust mission, which I want to get back to in a minute.
Yes.
Two key names at the head of the theorizing that there's life in space that occasionally encounters the Earth. In fact, their thesis was that life on Earth was seeded by these interplanetary cometary materials that occasionally bump into the atmosphere and leave their footprints or fingerprints. It was Fred Hoyle and a physicist named Chandra Wickramasinghe at Cardiff University. Well, Dr. Godfrey has Lewis has contacted Wickramasinghe, and that's where the scientist you see in the Yorkshire Post story, Milton Wainwright, comes in, because Wickramasinghe has turned the samples over to Wainwright, who's a colleague of his at Sheffield, and it's Wainwright who's doing the British analysis to check on all the claims and facts and figures that Lewis has published or is about to publish in his paper.
The old theories, Richard, of panspermia, which was life forms being brought to planets from objects, they talked primarily about comets, though, didn't they,
yeah,
in those days? And I guess they still do, but this could just revolutionize everything.
Well, we don't know the origin of this material. It's theorized by Dr. Lewis and some of the other people who looked at this that it was a comet, a small object like the Tunguska object that entered the atmosphere over India in 2001 and exploded in the air,
right,
because of the air pressure, and it had this material in it. But that's just a hypothesis. Nobody actually tracked a comet, and there is this report of an airburst of something, you know, which registered apparently on a couple of seismographs, but there's been no report of material on the ground, and you probably wouldn't find any holes or, you know, impact craters from something like that because it burst in the air. Where I get intrigued, and the reason I sent you this morning and made some of the comments I did is because obviously I believe this is incredible corroborative data for Van Flandern's exploding planet hypothesis. Because if the comets and the asteroids are really remnants of a whole world which had a biosphere like Earth, which orbited, you know, between Jupiter and Mars,
mm-hmm.
or had Mars as a satellite, as a moon, then if it blew up and fragments of it had been wandering around for the last 65 million years, which is what Tom's theory is, then when we occasionally encounter the right fragments, the right chunks, they would contain in a frozen form the life forms that came from the original planetary biosphere. And that's why this is so incredibly important, and why I again raise the question of stardust. Why have there been zero quarantine procedures to prevent contamination if stardust picked up from its cometary mission something like this?
Good point. I'm getting a lot of messages, too, from people who are saying, just remind Richard, Mars is called the red planet, and this is red rain. Maybe it came from Mars.
Well,
possible?
No, it didn't, because, remember, we have a microscopic imager on the rovers, and they're seeing nothing like this. The red of Mars is sand. It's iron oxide, rusted dust. The red of this comes from a stain on little particles, little objects that are cell-like. They look like blood cells. Now, this is the most amazing thing, and this is not going to be in the astrophysics and space science paper, because frankly, Dr. Lewis felt that it would be pushing the envelope and they would reject the paper.
Right.
But
well,
in the laboratory, he has done some experiments where he has gotten these things to reproduce. They're alive, George, and they don't appear to have recognizable DNA.
What do you mean by they've been reproduced?
They've been multiplying.
On their own.
You know, like, you know, socks, one eats the other, but coat hangers multiply in the closet in the dark.
Yeah, yeah.
These things are multiplying, and Dr. Wainwright in the Post article, let me call it up here so I can get an actual quote, he said, and I quote, he's talking about the meteor.
And the fact, though, that it doesn't have any DNA similar to what we have on this planet throws out every theory about life, and it also backs up the possibility that life forms in this universe may be very different. You know, they may be based on not just carbon, for example.
Well, remember, they may have DNA, but it may not have shown up in the tests that Dr. Lewis applied. That's why Dr. Wainwright is doing a different set of tests. It says if there really is no DNA, the mystery will deepen and the extraterrestrial explanation becomes more likely, especially if it is possible to repeat the reproduction experiments left out of Dr. Lewis's paper for astrophysics and space science, because they seem too amazing to be true.
Here's a quote he was saying.
Have results in a few weeks.
They are clearly cells. This is what you sent
me.
No argument about it. They look like the spores of some kind of rust fungus. That's
what Wainwright said.
Yep.
Now, this is only the beginning of a whole series of people, because apparently Dr. Lewis picked up and saved a lot of material from the Kerala area. So there will be enough samples to send, just like NASA, sending little stardust specks around. A lot of more scientists, particularly when this is published in a peer-reviewed journal like Astrophysics and Space Science, will get intrigued, and they'll obviously want samples of their own. And fortunately, nature brought us a lot of samples, so there's going to be a tremendous rising curve of interest and papers on this. And frankly, this could be the breakthrough. This could be the straw that breaks the NASA cover-up's back.
What about the possibility of two-way traffic in the cosmos, as they're also possibly theorizing, Richard, that this blew off Earth and just came back? Is that possible?
You mean some kind of impact that sprayed it up into space?
Yeah, in the space and then down it came again.
Well,
somehow.
But that gets back to the DNA problem.
Well, that's true.
If the additional tests for DNA don't find DNA as the operative molecule for reproduction, yet these things are reproducing like bunnies, then you got a different origin of life wherever this stuff came from, and it's obviously not likely that it would be from Earth.
Good point. Stay with us. Richard C. Hoagland, our guest this hour, We'll open up the phone lines. You want to chat with Richard about Mars, anomalies on the moon, this story and others? It's your turn. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Going to make it easy to find this incredible story about the mysterious red rain. Is it harboring life? Lex has it posted right under Richard C. Hoagland's name under coasttocoastam.com under tonight's guest. By the way, here is a toll-free phone number for the critically acclaimed God, Man, and E.T. DVD series of Richard's. It's 1-877. This is a toll-free number. 877-345-6222. That's 877-345-6222. I like this series so much. I have one in Los Angeles, and then I keep one in St. Louis. It's a long series of DVDs, by the way, at least 6 hours minimum. 877-345-6222 for Richard C. Hoagland's God, Man, and E.T. Back in a moment. They're lining up to talk with you, Richard C. Hoagland. Interesting story on CNN, by the way. Just what you've been saying over the past several years. It says budget cuts and poor management may be jeopardizing the future of our eyes in orbit, America's fleet or environmental satellites, all because of NASA and all these problems. Incredible. Absolutely incredible. You there, Richard C.?
I'm here, yes.
Oh, there.
If you wanted me to get into that, that's going to be a long conversation.
No, I just wanted to say that you appear to be right again.
Well, there was a major hearing in the House a few days ago, which I watched, you know, very carefully, and a number of leading scientists in this country are extremely concerned that NASA is basically eating its seed corn, because even though it has a budget increase this year up to $16.8 billion, they are almost eliminating any increases in space science, which means we'll have missions for the next couple, 3 years, and then you have nothing in the way of robotic probes like the rovers, like Cassini, like Stardust. And this comes in around the 2010 timeframe, which is just before 2012, and some night you and I need to discuss the implications of this.
Yeah, absolutely. I thought you were going to start planning my 2012 show. It's a little too early for that. Let's go to some calls. You ready?
Yep.
West of the Rockies, you're on Coast to Coast with Richard C. Hoagland. Hi there.
Oh, hi, guys. Good evening.
Good evening.
I just am enjoying listening to about the red dust from God knows where.
It's not dust. It is not dust. It's actually biological something that can reproduce.
Excellent. Well, I have another question for you, Richard. Have you seen the latest latest navigation cameras from Mars, from SOL 6768 yet?
I've seen the panorama, the color panorama of home plate, and
well,
there are some pretty interesting things on that landscape, but I haven't seen the nav camera shots you're mentioning.
Well, I'm looking at it right now, and I swear to you, it looks like a pond with water in it.
Okay.
And so here I am looking at this, and you guys are talking about life on other planets. It's at the NASA, it's a navigation camera SOL 768, and there's about 60 pictures, and of them, there is 8 showing what looks to be a pond, including a stone that seems to be half submerged in water.
I'll have to take a look.
Great.
Okay, thanks. That would be something, wouldn't it?
Well, you know, there's been this controversy for years, George. What is really the environment of Mars? And it started out with the color, the fact that even going back to Viking, there are stories from credible people of NASA kind of jigging the color so that it looks a lot harsher and blander than it really is. Then we have indications. I mean, Keith Laney has got on his website some astonishing color themis images from orbit that I have compared on the Enterprise site to lakes in the American Southwest, like in Utah, the Great Salt Lake. When you put the images side by side, if I didn't tell you that the color image was from Mars, you would have thought I was showing you a picture of the Great Salt Lake. So there is this mystery. What is really the environment of the red planet? And has NASA committed the ultimate sin, which is to lie about the ultimate environment, which is far more hospitable than they have let us know?
Do they analyze these pictures and then tell us what they are, or do they just put them out there on their website?
some, well, there's so many pictures, they haven't analyzed more than maybe 1%, even that. They're basically put out there for people like you and I and, you know, this audience to look at and wonder about, but there are very few papers that are written about any of the anomalies. In fact, there are no papers written within the community, the so-called planetary science community, that cover any of these anomalies. They're simply ignored.
Well, I'm going to have Lex look for this picture too, Richard, and see if he can get that posted. So
okay,
we can,
and I'll try I'll to send him that Laney shot, which looks eerily in color like the Great Salt Lake. I mean, when you take a picture looking down at water from orbit, if the lake bottoms shallowly, meaning it doesn't drop off like a cliff at the edge, you'll see it get lighter blue, darker blue, darker blue, and then it'll go deep black in the center where the light doesn't bounce back up from the bottom. The Salt Lake in Utah does this, and there's this picture, which I think I've got filed properly so I can find it, on Laney's site showing this color something on Mars that looks blue, shallow, and identical to the Great Salt Lake in Utah.
That's incredible.
Now, we know what the current pressures and temperatures that NASA's told us about Mars, you can't have that stuff happening. So if there really is liquid water, as this caller, you know, pointed out on this latest NavCam image, something is rotten in Washington.
Well, as our guest next hour will talk about, Marvin Herndon, Dr. Marvin Herndon, he's going to talk about how some planets have self-energy within, including Earth, and he's going to explain that. It's very possible Mars heats up its own self, isn't it?
Well, Mars, probably not, because whatever happened died when the planet blew up that was orbiting, going back to the Van Flandern model. But we know the moon, as it orbits Earth, is unusually hot. How do we know that? Because back during the Apollo program, when the 17 astronauts put heat probes into the moon, they found the flux of heat coming from the interior was something like, I think, 10 times expected for a dead moon. And we know that Jupiter and Saturn, Uranus and Neptune, are all radiating between 2 and 3 times as much energy into space as comes from the sun. So I've had a model out there for years based on the hyperdimensional physics that I talked about in L.A., which basically accounts for this additional mysterious energy and where it comes from. And, in fact, it even accounts for its presence in the sun, because if our model is right, then most of the energy coming from the sun is not coming from thermonuclear reactions, and there's some data on that that at some point in the future we can discuss.
Wildcard Line, you're on the air with Richard C. Hoagland on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, good morning.
Yes, sir.
I love listening to the show as I work on the internet at nighttime, and I'm trying desperately to like take a lot of it very seriously, because you know everything. I just wonder why every time I hear about the ET stuff, it always sounds like an episode from X-Files where they've got the stuff but they can't really report it. You know, I mean, in today's day and age, the government employees who are watched like hawks can leak information to the press about spying on people overseas, and yet we can't get this information into the hands of the media who can tell us for real that it's really happening.
If a lot of the media would tell us.
Yeah.
You know, that's where George and Art and this network is very much at the forefront, because they have for years been the first to report on important and anomalous stories.
And now we're beginning to report on also breaking things like the UAE port story and things like that. And it's all because of this vast audience, Richard, the contacts that we've developed with this program. Absolutely staggering.
You know, is the caller still there?
No.
Okay. If he goes to the website that I gave out a little while ago and that Lex has posted, he will find direct links to the actual paper that Dr. Lewis is submitted for publication and has been accepted. He will find a number of news stories from Science, from New Scientist. He'll find previous papers that they wrote back as far as 2003 on this cometary panspermia of the red rain over Kerala. There's a wonderful set of links and references on Dr. Lewis's website. So, you know, just go there and you'll find everything you need to know up to the moment on this extraordinary development.
Dr. Wainwright that we were talking about expects to have results that he's studying within a few weeks. He says he will make no public announcement until he's sure of his experiments.
Well, what he's trying to do is, of course, replicate what Dr. Lewis is going to publish.
Sure.
And the fact that Chandra Vikramasinghe turned over the data to him as opposed to taking it for himself. I mean, Vivek Ramaswamy is controversial. And you know, George, from my appearances on this show, that the more controversial you are, the more the mainstream will reject, regardless of your data, what you have found or what you claim.
Right.
So Vivek Ramaswamy has done a very politically smart move here by giving the samples to a colleague who has not been involved in this whole controversy. Wainwright's data will be looked at for the data as opposed to the reputations.
Let's go east of the Rockies. You're up with us on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hello, my name is Bruce. I'm listening to you on 104.7 out of Pittsburgh.
Oh, welcome, Bruce.
I was wondering, I wanted to ask Mr. Hoagland, did this substance that was in the rain contain any carbon?
Yes, it appears to contain hydrogen, oxygen, iron, a trace of iron, sodium, and other materials, and the actual chemical breakdown will be found in Dr. Lewis's paper, which is available through that web link that Lex has posted.
I thought it might be a crystalline substance that multiplied. You know, crystals grow.
That's exactly. That's one possibility. But apparently, see, Lewis is a solid-state physicist. So you would expect him to be intimately familiar with crystal growth and materials like that. So I would say that that's not what's going on, that that would be so obvious it would have been the first thing he would have rejected. But you got to read his paper. I must admit I haven't had time in the rush of all the things happening today to read the paper itself. But if you do, you'll find the questions or the answers to the questions you're asking.
Will that be on Enterprise? Will I be able to contact that?
Yeah, we'll also put a link up on Enterprise.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Bruce. What did you think when you saw this story this morning, Richard? What was the first thing you thought of?
I felt really good for Van Flandern because Tom and I, as you know, have had a really hard time getting serious attention to this. And the idea that all of these various dots come together and support, you know, see, Hoyle and Wickramasinghe, they're talking about these objects as primordial, that life somehow forms in space and then infects us periodically or semi-periodically when we run into junk comets and material like that. I think it's more likely that we're looking at the remnants of a shattered biosphere in frozen, you know, stasis that's wandering the solar system in these cometary objects, and when it runs into the Earth, sometimes it contains biological material and sometimes not. And in this case, we've got enough material and enough real people. I mean, look, the review board of astronomy and astrophysics and space science are no pushovers. They must have really gone through Dr. Lewis's paper with a fine-tooth comb. And if they saw after the review process that it was still fit to print, you know he must have robust data and robust procedures, and he's done everything by the book.
Well, I got to tell you, these stories that continue to come out that add credence to what I used to think were wild theories of Richard C. Hoagland.
Oh, when did you think that?
Well, years ago. Years
when
ago.
When you were sitting in your driveway listening to us?
Years ago, when I was a boy listening to you.
Oh, well, years. Oh, yeah, okay.
But now I'm beginning to realize that there is a very real science to what you do. And people are starting to take notice now.
You know, it's really a shame you didn't see the 2012 stuff in L.A. And we won't go into all the weird things that happened that prevented that. But if you want to come and see how the dots really connect, George, come to San Francisco at the end of April at the New Living Expo. I'm going to do it again. I'm going to lay out what happened vis-a-vis 2012 or what's going to happen in terms of our models and our data and our research. And you will have your eyebrows lifted several feet above your head.
Interesting. Why don't you just send me the tape?
We might do that.
First-time caller line. You're on with Richard C. Hoagland. Hi there.
Hey, it's a pleasure.
Well, thank you for calling. Go ahead, sir.
What you're talking about, this life form that's from outer space, it reminds me of a movie called Evolution, and in it, this professor is talking to another teacher, and he's saying, we found something that has 10 base pairs of DNA. And this professor says, well, so what? And they, well, there's only 4 base pairs for all of life on Earth. And that would be the question that I'm looking at, is this something that's from Earth, or is life different?
Oh. That is the key question, and I think you put your finger on a really interesting idea. I think, George, that they're going to eventually find that this stuff, it does have DNA, some kind of molecule that moderates the reproduction process, but that it's not terrestrial, meaning it's more like, as the caller said, you know, multiple-strand DNA. And the reason they won't have found it so far is because when you do a DNA test, it's like those chemistry things we used to do back in the lab where you put a beaker full of something and you drop something else in it and you watch what color it turns. It's a very crude test for DNA. No one has looked at this with a standing electron microscope to see the twisted double strands, okay? That's expensive and down the line. So they're trying various simple chemical tests to see if there's DNA in this stuff, and they're not finding it, which leads them, obviously, to more complex tests. So this is an unfolding story that over the next several weeks, we could have one heck of a program here discussing what they ultimately announce.
I sure hope they don't get contaminated, Richard. I hope they know what they're doing here.
Well, I mean, we're dealing with professional scientists. Wainwright is talking about keeping his samples in the freezer. I presume because they're dealing with biologicals that there were appropriate packaging, you know, when they collected samples and all that. But that's again, one of those, you know, biology 101 things that professional scientists know how to do.
Yeah, I remember a few years ago when they sent out some vaccines to some 3,000 labs.
Yes. Well, that was a paperwork. That was a management thing. That wasn't a scientist making a stupid mistake. That was a management person making a stupid mistake.
But, I mean, they reached into the old refrigerator and sent it out to everybody.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. Well, that was bureaucracy. This is science, thank God.
Wild card
line. And it's independent science.
Well, that's true. You're on with Richard C. Hoagland. Hi there.
Hi, George. This is Blair listening on 780 KAZM
in Sedona. Hi there, Blair.
Hi, Richard.
Good old Sedona. Hi, Blair.
Hey, back in October 16th, Richard, you talked about doing final fact-checking on the Deep Impact spacecraft.
Yeah, I knew you were going to bring that up. We have something so remarkable on the Deep Impact mission that I have been basically waiting for confirmation, the last, you know, dots, the last crossing of the T's and dotting of the I's. And it's been slow coming in because of the politics. But I will say that it is connected to this story in a very interesting fashion. And at the moment, that's all I can say. I can't give you the end of the story yet because we don't have it.
Would I be able to give a one-sentence theory of my own?
Sure.
Well, I think it's the comet is actually showing a healing of the wound, the crater, so to speak, and that's got the NASA scientists freaked out. It's a living entity.
Nice, but no cigar.
What a great theory.
It's a great theory, but I don't think it's right.
It's like a dragon in space or something like that.
Well, you got to ask yourself, if these things are in pockets in cometary material, what happens when the pockets warm up and they reproduce in the comet? I mean, Blair's on to something. We could send a mission to a comet someday, and it could be, you know, like something read out of the 1950s comic books, where something red with tentacles reaches up and snatches the ship and the astronaut. I'm being a little facetious, but...
Well, but like you say, Richard, you know, if it is life, you know, if it's on a comet, I'd like to know how it got there.
Exactly.
And the only way, yeah.
And that's why the next few weeks are going to be very, very interesting on this story.
You got it. Thanks, Richard. Good story. Appreciate you being on Coast to Coast. Richard C. Hoagland, Science Advisor, EnterpriseMission.com. Wow, this hour just buzzed by. We'll be back in a moment with Dr. Marvin Herndon as we talk about some more incredible science theories on Coast to Coast AM.